Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Tom, if you can stuff any food inside of any other food, what would it be?
I'm going to go with lamb stuffed with bacon, wrapped with truffle French fries, stuffed with lamb.
How do you get a lamb inside a French fry?
Or maybe crusted, French fry crusted lamb with bacon also there. I don't know what it looks like. Maybe it's kind of like a burrito of lamb.
I think I'm stuffing a Bojangles steak biscuit, like wrapped with a slice from Sal and Carmine's on Broadway and 101st.
That's pizza.
That's pizza.
With a steak biscuit inside of it.
Anything can be stuffed inside pizza. This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, we continue our march through season six, the vaunted season six, the season that Tom Colicchio himself regards as the pinnacle of Top Chef. There are five chefs left. Fascinating time capsule. We know these chefs. This is the younger version. The one thing that isn't aged is, have you noticed that Pava looks no different than she does in 2019?
I know. It's depressing. You know, when you watch this show and then you see the All-Stars where Kevin Gillespie's just lost all of his hair on his head and you're like, and there's Padma who looks exactly like she did in 2009. Or, you know, even in the next episode, they tease the next episode and Padma's got like bangs and you're like she just looks, I think she had bangs this most recent season in LA too. So I don't know. I maybe we need to do like a probe and figure out whether she has this, like, just she doesn't age. I don't know what it is, but it really is amazing to watch when I don't know what Thomas Keller looks like now, but you know, it was cool to watch this episode because to me, Kevin, this felt like a finale episode. The stakes were super high. Thomas Keller and like 12 incredible chefs are at the dining room table. There's a $30,000 cash win prize, and they've whittled it down from 5 to 4 at the end of this episode. I know that they're still in Vegas for this, but it really did feel like a finale to me.
Well, I think typically on the show, and it's something that I think has sort of shaped over several years, the 5 to 4 frequently does feel sort of more suspense than even a finale sometimes. I just think that the competition's more intense. You know, like the finales, beautiful as they are, it's like they hang out in a half the episode, like in a market in Macau. You know, the ratio of cooking and stress of cooking to other stuff is just pretty low. So I've always loved the 5 to 4. I always loved the penultimate episode before a finale. I think it's truly, you know, one of the just maybe the best episode in the season behind Restaurant Wars.
You know what it is, Kevin? It's the NCAA tournament.
It's the Elite Eight.
It's the Elite Eight. It's like you're going to the Final Four, but it always kind of feels, not that the Final Four is a letdown, but it almost feels like the Final Four is the goal, right? Is like the March Madness truly happens in those first three rounds. And then once it gets into the Final Four, it got kind of like, you know, the air gets taken out a little bit of that March Madness and it becomes more of a traditional championship, right? But in Top Chef, it's the same thing. It's like the first 12 episodes of Top Chef is March Madness. And then once they get into the finale where they travel across the country, it kind of turns into a different show. And we know this season that the four best chefs in season 6 are going to the finale. And I can't imagine if you watch this real time. I don't know if you have a really good finger on the pulse of who's going to win this damn thing.
I totally agree. In my notes, very prominently with a highlight is I can't remember an episode where we went to judges table and I had no clue what was going down. It was everybody's was a little bit, a lot of A-minus work, a lot of A-minus work. And which left it wide open. Nobody hit this out of the park.
Yep.
And, you know, totally agree. I thought, and the conceit was hard. I mean, let's start at the beginning. Do you want to explain to our listeners, although if you've watched the episode, the Bocuse d'Or is just like, what is that? The World Series of Poker of cooking?
Kevin, I never knew about this. Like, I know I watched this season way back when, but when I rewatched it now, I'm like, this is kind of the prototype of modern cooking TV, right? Like Iron Chef, you know, like this idea of like super big, like mano y mano, like one-on-one competition. Like this is where it was born from. Bocuse d'Or is an international competition where it's basically gastronomy Olympics. Every 4 years or every 2 years or whatever it is, there's a stadium, there's an audience, there's teams, there's history. Like this is awesome. Like I didn't know about this, but I would love to go to something like this one day, you know? And I don't know if there's a direct line to like, were there producers for Bocuse d'Or and, you know, Iron Chef or Top Chef or any of these cooking competitions. But this is kind of the prototype, wasn't it?
I mean, I do think. I mean, it was Top Chef before there was Top. It was real life Top Chef. So I thought that was, you know, that was pretty interesting. Let's start. We're going to get to the final, the finale. But I mean, I don't know how I feel about this quick fire. I kind of shared a criticism that Michael Voltaggio had, where you know they kind of present it with this very, it's a mini Bocuse d'Or. And it's like, no, what they're telling you to do is make a Ballantine. Now, Tom, if you remember, the only previous Ballantine on Top Chef, you and I ate. Do you remember the chicken Ballantine at Restaurant Northeast in Lexington, Kentucky? Remember Brian? Brian comes out with the chicken Ballantine. And by the way, I think it was the best dish we had that night.
100%.
So a Ballantine is basically a turducken with whatever the hell you're doing. It doesn't have to be a turkey and a duck. But for those playing at home, it is a turducken. You stuff something inside of something else.
And it was delicious. I remember that. And so that's what they're doing in the quickfire.
I mean, essentially. So some creative, to a degree. I mean, I don't think it was a strict parameter, though. Michael Voltaggio was a little irritated that they they dinged him for doing Tureen because it wasn't stuffed inside something. So as he said, wait, why didn't they just say do a Ballantine? So Jim does a very traditional, like three of the five chefs go with a pretty Ballantine-ish option, right? Like Jen does the turducken of seafood, which I love because I'm a big calamari steak guy. And, you know, you got the salmon wrapped in the scallops, wrapped in the calamari steak, a little shiso. Big fan of what Jen does always. This was fantastic. Kevin also does a little bit of seafood. He does a fried catfish, which who doesn't love fried catfish, Tom?
Yeah.
Southern fried catfish.
And we've heard it from Kevin before where he's like, no, I disagree with the chefs quite a bit. They didn't show how much I basically discredited their judgment on my dish. Like, he sticks to his guns, and we saw a lot of it here was when they said it was overcooked, it was a little dry, and he's like, nope, I'm going to disagree with you on that one. Not true.
I kind of feel that way sometimes about my drafts. You know, they go into the editors, they got issues, and it's like, now you morons, this is really good stuff. And by the way, just so our audience knows, it also goes the other way. I turn in stuff that I think is shit. And they're like, we don't have much to do here. I'm like, all right. You know, so it goes both ways. But
you're also the editor on a lot of work. So you anymore. Also have that perspective. Whereas, you know, Kevin Gillespie, I don't know if he's a judge, but he seems to judge his food like he is a judge.
Look, obviously Padma and Tom are the show. You know what would be a really fun Top Chef season? The judges should be an all-star team. Like, it's Michael Voltaggio, Jen Carroll, and Mai Lin, or but that's not fair because Michael Voltaggio was sous chef, so that would be too similar in sensibility. But like Kevin Gillespie would be a good judge, you know. I mean, why not just Melissa? I mean, that would be like, why not have a season? And I don't know how you still incorporate Padma and Tom because it's their show, and I want to defer there. But how about a season where the Top Chef judges are Top Chef chef-testants?
Ooh, I'll do it one further, Kevin. Call it Top Judge.
Top Judge?
So Top Judge. The chefs become the judges, and Padma, Gail, and Tom, and whoever you want to add into the mix, they're evaluating who is the best judge of their food based on
that's
based
a little meta, remarks. Man. I think we're taking out the fourth and fifth wall there.
Right. Oh, but they're competing to be the next judge of Top Chef, and it's great. I love both ideas. So, the Scotch egg that Eli does, they like it. The Jen, I was a skeptic. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a bad move. The idea of doing a calamari in case. An encased in calamari seafood dish, little out there, but she nails the execution. I want to eat it now. Fried catfish, okay, delicious.
Brian Voltaggio also does a sort of a traditional, not traditional, but he does the Merguez sausage wrapped in call fat, which I had to look up, Tom.
Call fat, please indulge me. What is call fat?
It's casing. It's basically casing. It feels similar and a smarter person than I am can correct us here, but it's kind of a casing, like from what you find in a sausage. And then he's got lamb in the middle of those. By the way, I want to tip my hat to Brian Voltaggio. How the hell does he make all those sauces in 90 minutes? Like, he's got three sauces going along with this three protein dish. Like, how the hell does he make all those sauces in 90 minutes? Like, much, much respect. Now, going back to Jim, though, I see one of the great things about calamari is it's a great wrapper. Like, you know what's great is you ever had, like, on a restaurant, have the, like, calamari stuff with chorizo? What a great combo that is, you know? So, you know, but I'm with you. Like, I was expecting kind of a meatier protein inside the calamari steak.
Well, so. Kevin, I don't know about you, but I did a little fist pump when I was watching when Padma turns to Jen and says, welcome back.
Welcome back. I like when they sort of acknowledge the momentum where it's not just like they're recognizing that the contour of a contestant's route here. Like I'm with you. I thought that was very cool.
It was awesome. That was such a cool moment. And it did strike me, you know, Jen has been on the bottom three, like three straight episodes. So she is in her head, big time in a rut. And to get that from Padma to be like, hey, welcome back, kid. That was awesome. So good for her. And that was, you know, this guy, Gavin Kaysen, I feel like he's coming from a Bocuse d'Or competition, it's almost like when NBA teams bring in like the military. Like, it's like, whoa, this guy's on another level. Like, we talk about competition and we talk about, like, you know, laying it out on the line. This guy coming in here from Bocuse d'Or, like, he is like, we think this is hard. Like, watching him come in and basically like explain what they did at this competition, it just felt almost majestic, like what he had accomplished. And so he's coming in here, and I thought Brian Voltaggio would nail this. The whole idea of Bocuse d'Or is almost like classical French cuisine, but elevated, right? Is like the presentation is just on another level. And I thought Michael Voltaggio was outplayed by his brother and consistently. And I think when Jen wins this, it was another instance of just when you think that Michael Voltaggio and Brian Voltaggio and Kevin are just a leg up on everybody, here comes Jen. And that was really cool to see. I was very happy to see that Jen won that one. Not the first time that I've been surprised by who wins a competition in this episode. I'll foreshadow the next segment here by saying I did not see Jen winning that one.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to defend Michael Voltaggio here. Like, I have no problem with Tureen as an interpretation. Like, I mean, maybe because it's not stuffed inside a stuffed inside. But as he said, if you want a balancing, just say you want a balancing. But that wasn't what you asked for. So I do feel a little bit for him. And I bet that freaking Tureen was great. You know, so I really applaud Eli. I find Scotch eggs to be weird. And I love the bacon crust is a cool thing, you know, like, you know, remember, you know what I used to love? Like, I eat it out of the little bottle is like, you know, bacon bits.
Bits. And remember, even if like, it's not like, real.
Oh, better if it's not real. Like synthetic bacon bits are great. And you love to see the bacon bits on the shitty salad bar. You love to see it at like pizza. You know, like, I mean, do you have that? I mean, you grew up in a tonier neighborhood than I did, but like. Like, you know, you got to love the pizza parlor where they just like send you off to the salad bar. I've talked about this on the show again, and it's just the same. It's lowbrow salad bar, but I love the lowbrow salad bar where you can just pour bacon bits on your Thousand Island dressing with like 2 ounces of lettuce and just basically use it as a vehicle for just a bunch of just shit.
I'm imagining this in my head, Kevin, is that this is just basically you're eating a bowl of Fruity Pebbles.
Yes.
But instead of milk, you're doing Thousand Island, and instead of Fruity Pebbles, you're doing bacon bits.
All right. I got to call out a good Fruity Pebbles situation I've had in the last month. Brodard is a brilliant Vietnamese restaurant in Fountain Valley now. It used to be, I think, in Westminster. This is in Orange County, California. And it is massive. Like, and if you go on a Saturday and Sunday morning, just tons of families. It like reminds me of like the Jewish delis on Sunday morning where it's like everybody's family and kids. It's such a great thing. And one of the things they do is a great bake shop, and they have macaroons. The best, you know, a lot of people are doing macaroons, Tom, these days, and a lot of people are doing a lot of C-plus macaroons, not Bredard. And they had a Fruity Pebbles macaroon as their special macaroon about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and which adds not only a third texture to the – really a fourth texture to the macaroon because you have the crust, the stuff inside the crust, the cream, and I'm calling Bredard tomorrow because I got to go down there. And I am asking if they have the Fruity Pebble macaroon, which was just brilliant. So if you are in the Orange County area.
That sounds amazing.
Bredard is just a great place. Great Vietnamese food.
I'm going to get in my little Fruity Pebbles homage too. When I was Chubby Tom, offensive lineman in middle school Tom.
Were you really chubby in high school?
I mean, not high school. I'm saying
you're a man
school.
With a round face, but I don't think I've ever thought of you as chubby. Ever.
When I was in middle school, I was being groomed to be an offensive lineman in high school for the all-state, like the state champion football team in Connecticut.
Ain't no way Westport's got an all-state football team. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. It's
far
true.
Too
it's
upscale true. A suburb to have the good football team. That shit's state coming champs. Out of Waterbury or something.
Staples High School was FCAC and state champs while I was there. So, I was being groomed. They were like, ooh, you got good footwork. You got good hands. But tell you what, you're going to have to put on 60 pounds because you need to beef up. And I was like, okay. So I started like getting really chubby I think like seventh grade, eighth grade. And what I would do is just eat like an entire box of Fruity Pebbles for breakfast with pancakes. And I loved Fruity Pebbles. And I would have this big light blue bowl. I can look at it right now in my head and just get, I'm salivating thinking about it. Fruity Pebbles is delicious.
Oh, they're so good.
I don't know. Can you riddle me this? Is each Fruity Pebble color a different flavor, or is it all the same flavor, but just different colors?
I think there is some.
Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, Noodle. Hey, boy. How you doing? And Noodle's just like, yeah, whatever.
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for your eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher-turned-podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order.
Some different. I think okay. Some of them are a little sour than some of them are a little sweet. And I think we would need to call, what is it, Post? Who does that?
I don't know. But next time we hang out, Kevin, we're gonna crush some Fruity Pebbles. But elimination challenge.
Yeah, anyway. We wanna go. So Jen wins that. Ballantine, Michael goes against the grain, doesn't win, although I suspect that dream was really good. One thing I didn't know going in is when you do the one protein, two garnish, that I didn't realize you have to do that whole setup. Like, that's not something I – like, that sushi tray with all the stuff.
That's what
like,
I was just going to say.
Like, you know what I was – like, I had no – I thought it was like, oh, it's a meat and three, except it's a meat and two. Like, I didn't know. Protein, two garnishes. And when he said garnish, I didn't know it was like – like, garnish to me is, you know, a little freaking parsley. Like, I didn't know that garnish is essentially – I mean, what they wanted you to do was canapes. At least that was my interpretation. I'm a vulgarian, and I know nothing about the Bocuse d'Or and sort of classical French cooking in that respect. But Anyway, I was like a shocked. Sushi boat. I didn't understand it. Right, like, it looked like a sushi thing on all these little canapes.
You know, I was super impressed by all of them in this episode. Like, to do that in such short time, and I'm so glad Gail said it at the end, is like to find out about Bocuse d'Or in 12 hours and then produce those dishes. Like, those looked so impressive presentation wise. And I know that they didn't execute as well as they had hoped because of the time constraint, but shit, like the Bocuse d'Or is like an Olympiad. Like, what do you expect them to do? You know, they didn't have huge staffs to work on this. This was just a single person trying to trot out an elevated salmon or lamb dish protein with two garnishes that the idea is a zucchini basket with something else in it. Like, that is a high bar and just about cleared it. That was – and then you got Thomas Keller walking in. Come on, Kevin. This was a hard episode.
I think it was a very high degree of difficulty. And as we said, no one really hit it out of the park. And you know what's funny? For all of the presentation and all of the degree of difficulty, it's kind of the old Top Chef thing. If you don't nail the protein, you don't like cut it right, and you don't cook it right, you're kind of out. Like, you're not in real contention. And so at the end of the day, it was funny. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's really Brian Voltaggio. I think he had – I loved that. I mean, that crapignier, it was a crapignette, and then the orzo pasta balls. Like, I thought it was great. If he nailed the lamb, I think he wins, but he didn't nail the lamb.
He didn't nail the lamb. Undercooked, yeah. And it was, you know what? I'm cool with that, but when they're starting to talk about that the lamb fat wasn't, it was just grotesque. I'm like, man, I do like a rare lamb, so I'm not so sure I would be as critical as they were, but. Yeah, both of the lamb dishes here in this episode looked very, very raw.
It was, I mean, again, there were some interesting choices, I thought. I mean, you know, and I wonder about Michael Voltaggio. If he doesn't call it Mediterranean, is he, I mean, look, Grant, mm-hmm. They didn't love his the little tzatziki inside the cucumber thing, which was kind of, frankly, a little elementary for him, right? I mean, I thought that was a little, just not Michael Voltaggio-esque, but Mediterranean inspired. I feel like it was one of those things where the minute you call it something, they start nitpicking at the name.
Yeah.
And it really, that seemed like it was 40% of the criticism was, this isn't Mediterranean. He should have just called it something. You know what? You don't have to call it anything.
Yeah, but you have to come up with a story, like what's the harmony in the dish, or what's the throughway with the dish? Like, I think that was a question that he got, was what inspired you to make it this way? He had to come up with a story. Did he have to say Mediterranean? No. But you also, if you are going to call it Mediterranean, don't be like, yeah, I was cooking it and then halfway through I realized it was Mediterranean flavors, so I decided to make it Mediterranean. So you're almost admitting that you didn't really have a vision going in and you just kind of made it up on the fly. So, like it always happens on the show, you kind of have to have your story, your narrative, your arc pre-made, pre-packaged, so that when you get asked about it, you're not going to be stumbling over it. So Michael Voltaggio wasn't his best performance. I think maybe his worst performance of the season. Maybe a few episodes ago when he really thought he was going home, maybe. But this was not a good launch pad into the finale. Did I think he was going home? No. But this was an off day.
Yeah. I mean, he still had the best presentation, I think, by a good bit.
Yeah, yeah. Now let's talk about Brian for a sec. Okay. Brian does this crusted loin of lamb.
Yeah, partially encrusted. And he sous vide the lamb.
Okay. Sous vide the lamb. Glad you mentioned that. When they're deciding what to do, and Brian Voltaggio gets asked by Kevin in the little lounge area at the house, hey, how do you do sous vide? Kevin, I want to ask you, how do you play that? There's five contestants left. One of your top competitors is choosing to do a dish that he's never done before, prepared before, but he knows you, Kevin. He knows this is your forte. And he asks you, Kevin, hey, you know, I don't know how to do this, but what temperature do I need it at? How do you play that?
It took me aback too. You're down to five. I mean, and let's face it, you two are maybe, you know, you're both championship contenders, and you get a very elementary question, and there's a part of Brian Beltaggio who has to be thinking, I don't know, asshole, why are you asking me on with five left? Like, you don't know how to do this basic cook method, this vacuum sealed. Like, sorry, I can't help you. You know, I'm not here to teach remedial cooking. And I think that would have been, you know, one of the interesting themes, and also now that we're doing in the Wayback Machine, watching this season 10 years after the fact, is one of the criticisms, Michael Beltaggio's leveled it in kind of a bitchy way. He cooks what I cook on my off night. While Kevin was at the judges' table, the big knock on his dish was that it was elementary, right? Like, he's not playing with the form. He's not playing with the food the way Michael and to a great extent Brian is. And I mean, frankly, if you go to Gun Show today, I mean, Gillespie is a far more technically advanced chef. I mean, it is like, it's fun to watch Gillespie, the 2009 Gillespie, knowing that I've eaten his food in like 2018 and we know what he's capable of now, or for that matter, you know, All Stars and everything else. So that's sort of been one of the fun themes, is he's gone from this guy is, hey, everybody loves your food, but you're not exactly reinventing the form here. And now he does so much of that at his restaurants while still preserving who he is. But I'm with you. Like, it's a little bit, by the way, a little ballsy of Kevin to add, a lot of chutzpah for him to even ask another chef.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so I made the same observation. Like, I thought that was really interesting.
And Brian plays ball. He, in the confessional, says, you know, should I have said anything? I mean, I don't know. It's kind of weird to be asking me for technique advice when it's down to five at this late in the competition. But what would have been really funny is if he just straight up sabotaged him and said, so the temperature you want on that chicken, I think it's like 100 and 105 maybe, and just totally blown up his spot. And just as a way of like, you know what, this is a damn competition. You shouldn't be at – if you're going to get mad at me for giving you the wrong advice, don't ask the advice. We're in a freaking competition here.
Actually, what you do is you cut off the head of a chicken first, and then you swing it around your head. And like, you could just kind of, you're right, you could just prescribe some nonsense to, like, this is what you have to do to sous vide.
And instead, Kevin gets the advice. He executes his dish. And I think what I learned from this is Kevin – When he says I'm more simple, or other people call it elementary, what he's really doing, Kevin, is he knows he's got to execute. As long as I execute this dish, I'm going to be good. And what other chefs are going to say is like the Robin route, or the Katsuji route, is like, I'm going to pull this and then do this and then this. And then, oh my God, I'm running out of time. How is that possible? And like the Ash rule of like, oh, I didn't have this and I didn't have that. Kevin might not have the most imaginative and creative and technically advanced dish, but what he does have is a dish. It is executed and it's fully formed. And at the end of the day, I don't care how simple it is, what you're betting on is that everybody else is not going to be able to execute what they want. And in this episode, the simplicity was the idea. That was the thing that got him the win, was I might be simple and elementary, but I actually completed and executed the dish. And I think that's a skill. I think that is actually, in this competition, a skill. It might seem like a weakness. It's like LeBron passing in the last moment of the game instead of taking the shot. Some people might construe what Kevin does on this show as a weakness, that it's simple, that it's elementary, and that I do it my day off. But I think it's actually a smart play. I'm going to do something where it's actually executable, whereas you're just going to be flying off the cuff and screaming, oh my God, I can't believe there's only 1 minute left.
I agree and disagree. So on one hand, I look, he executes. I don't think he has anything to apologize for. His food is his food, at least circa 2009. I don't think he won this week as much as they lost it. And I think you're a probability guy. What are the odds of Michael, Brian, and Jen all kind of bricking their file. I mean, he basically, I mean, what, 1 in 4 times 1 in 4 times 1 in 3 maybe? You know, like what is that, Tom? That's 1 in 6, 8. What is it? 1 in 48, right? I mean, and I think, I'm not going to say he got lucky. He executed.
Nope, you're doing the wrong math here, Kevin. Wait, what am I? I think the math he's doing in his head is this is a really hard challenge. Everyone is going to try to reinvent the wheel here. Michael Voltaggio, Brian Voltaggio, Jen, they're going to get inside their head. They're going to try to just make themselves into a pretzel here to impress these chefs. And they're going to extend themselves way too thin. And I am going to go the opposite direction. I am actually going to do something that I can execute. So even though these are all amazing chefs, I think Kevin might have been zigging while everyone's zagging actually raises his – by choosing I'm going to raise my floor – They're thinking, I'm going to raise my ceiling. He's thinking, I want to raise my floor. And I think that actually is good probability. I think those are good odds in this circumstance.
I mean, I guess. I mean, it seems like he's playing. I mean, not intentionally, but it seems like a second place strategy, because I think the odds are one of those three people beat you by virtue of their difficulty. But hey, I mean, look, scoreboard, right? He wins.
Yeah.
Is sherry glaze, the parsley sauce, the pickled Swiss chard stems, I thought were a really nice touch. And even though the baked asparagus with sunchoke cream was frankly a little elementary for this particular thing. And I'm not trying to knock Kevin. I mean, I love his food.
Hey, they said it.
I think now, you know, Brian, again, you just undercooked the lamb. And the same thing goes, you know, with Eli, who did it in he screwed up the protein in a more spectacular way, if you will. Yeah. I mean, it's overcut. Tom Colicchio, you got to cut that meat the right way. He is almost Japanese in his precision of cutting the protein. He does not fuck around. He is not going to let you, like, you know, what did you cut that
literally
with a blindfold?
Yeah.
Yeah. He has no time for that. One of the judges, I forget which, just sort of referred to the dish as sad, which has got to be just a brutal insult. Sad.
Yeah, he was essentially saying this lamb sacrificed his life for nothing.
Right. It was wrapped around the loin. In many ways, he basically did something very similar to Brian Voltaggio, except with the lamb sausage wrapped around the loin, encrusted with pistachio. Razzle Hanu, I have some Razzle Hanu spice blend that I love. With a carrot puree, tomato and piquillo pepper marinated on top of beer. I mean, I think it was a really well-conceived dish. I have to say, like, to me, it might have been my favorite conceived dish.
Eli's dish.
Yeah. I really loved
the idea. Well, the problem is he had
the worst
meat. He had the worst meat. Right. And like you said, that's a killer. I mean, you got to nail the protein. He didn't nail the protein. He actually ruined it in two different ways. He undercooked it, and then he had a uneven cut. What did you think about Thomas Keller being impressed by the garlic chip? I thought that was a really cool moment.
Yeah, I was frankly surprised. I mean, you're right. It seems like, I mean, it's something that, you know, it's funny. That is such a talk about a 2009 kind of thing you'd see on the plate that you just don't see now. A garlic chip, right? Like it was the moment of the garlic chip. It was interesting that was sort of something he was drawn to. You know, Jen had one of those dishes, Tom, where the show's limitations, which are you and I cannot taste it at home, kind of was at work, right? Because I saw that poached salmon with caviar and enoki mushrooms. That's some three of my favorite foods. A shrimp flan with a snap pea salad. Lovely. Like light truffles, celery root shiitake, like mushrooms little bright flavors and a little salt and rich, you know, salmon's a nice fatty fish. Like it's the kind of dish that I would have ordered, that I would have been psyched to be put on the table. And it's hard to kind of know, it didn't have the flavor. It was not exciting. It's sort of like explain, because it is one of those things where, look, it's my greatest, it's not a knock on the show. There's nothing they can do, but it's like, to the extent that Project Runway has this thing where you can see it, we can never taste the food. We can argue with the refs all day. But at the end of the day, Tom, other than unless you go to Restaurant Wars in Lexington, Kentucky, bless them for letting us do that. You just don't know.
You don't know. I thought Jen's dish was – I would order it on a menu. It seems like the kind of dish that I'd be thinking about for a long time after I ate it. Like that is the stuff that you'll be thinking about. Another thing I want to touch here is I think Brian Voltaggio is too nice. It's too nice.
Are you going back to the
Kevin thing where Kevin's asking for advice, but also in the kitchen, Michael Voltaggio, his brother, his greatest competition, is asking for help in the competition with his dish. And Brian's like, yeah, I got you. I think Brian needs to be a little bit meaner. I think in this episode, he ran out of time, and I'm seeing him helping Kevin, helping Michael Voltaggio. And he needs a little bit more of a mean streak. I think that might help him here. And I get it. It's hard to put away like your consideration for other human beings and sympathy and all that. Like, I get it. It's hard to do in competition, but I just kind of feel like he needs a little bit more of a mean streak here. And Jen, even though she gets the 30 minutes of extra time, she doesn't really need it. So she's helping other people out as well. And it kind of goes back to this whole theory, this debate of when you're on Top Chef, are you there to make friends? Or are you there to win? And I think in some ways, the goodwill that you earn by helping others, actually, you get a credit that you will get paid off later on. And I think there is a strategy in being nice because you might need them to step up for you and they're more willing to do it when you've stepped up for them. So I don't know where I feel about it. I just think that Brian needs to be a little bit meaner.
I mean, I suppose. But there is a code with these five contestants. I mean, I think, you know, you're right, though. Michael Voltaggio wouldn't be nearly as helpful. He's the mean brother. By the way, as we said before, you know, as we get to the end here, neither of us had any idea who they were going to name the winner. I can't recall a week of Top Chef in recent memory, multiple seasons, where I had no idea who they were going to name.
I know this. I didn't think Kevin was going to win it. At least I didn't think he was likely. And when they said Kevin, I was like, wait, we just listened to them just trash him for being too simple the whole time. And then I guess you're right, is that he didn't necessarily win as much as the others lost. And it was a matter of, okay, this game was 78-76 and one team happened to win, right? And I think it just goes to show that this challenge was so hard. And the audience was so decorated. Like hearing them talk and their histories, I was like, wow, this is incredibly difficult to pull off. And Kevin wins. At this point, you know, Kevin has four wins. Jennifer has one win. Brian has three wins. Michael has three wins. So I guess Kevin's going into the finals with four wins, making him the favorite. Sorry, he's got five wins, making him the favorite, right? Like going into this next phase, I guess you put Kevin as the most likely winner here.
Well, it's a question, and you mentioned it earlier, ceiling and floor, right? Like I think Michael Voltaggio's ceiling is higher than anybody's. Now, I wouldn't say his floor is lower, but I think Kevin hits his peak more often. He just happens to have a lower peak. And I think what's interesting, it's always been the case about Top Chef, right? Like at the, generally speaking, the high ceiling chef, ultimately, when you get down, when the flaws start being, hey, it was great, but there wasn't as much, you know, ingenuity to what you did. We can't criticize anything specific that was wrong on the plate, that was wrong in the preparation, for that matter, was wrong in the presentation, right? And I think as the errors, not even errors, as the criteria become more, you know, how ambitious were you? Did you just go shoot? Did you shoot the moon? I think if I'm looking ahead, it's, you know, Kevin, obviously the most consistent winner, Michael's ceiling is a little higher.
Yeah. Yeah, Jen's kind of the wild card where if she's hitting her shots, she's feeling in rhythm, she can win the whole damn thing. To wrap up here, where are they now? Eli Kirstein is I'm hope to get him on the pod one of these days. We have touch base with him and hopefully we'll be getting him on the show. It was sad to see him go. Like literally he was crying and It was interesting to see Eli's little like vignette in the beginning of the show about how Richard Blaze is his mentor, and he was the best man at Richard's wedding. Is that right? Do we have that correctly?
I think he said that. Now Richard's a bit older than Eli, I believe.
So this is – I wish we'd known that before. Like, why didn't they tell us this at the beginning of this season? Would have given him a little bit more of not credibility, but a little bit more texture to his story. I thought that was an interesting throw-in at the end of his tenure. Is like, oh, by the way, Richard Blaze is like my mentor, and we're like super close. So where are they now? August, recently he had closed down a couple years ago. He closed down his restaurant, The Luminary. He opened that up in the, maybe you can explain it. Is it the Krog Street?
Oh, Krog Street Market. My sister lives right over there. It's a wonderful place. And I've eaten at The Luminary. I ate there with, some of our basketball friends.
No way.
And yeah. I mean, Charlie Widows was, I believe, there. And so I think we went there. Or maybe I'm confusing. Yeah. But the point is Krog Street Market is a wonderful, one of those food halls. But within the food hall, they have the stands. But in like around the perimeter, like and toward the back, there are some smaller restaurants with some seating, like you know, where a full service restaurant, you know, with a couple dozen seats. So, some of my favorite stuff was there. I mean, it's great. They've lost some of my favorites. The Cock and Trees was one of my all-time favorites. It's a great scene. It's one of, you know, Pont City Market, Krog Street Market. Atlanta's so fantastic for food. I really hope it survives, you know, the current moment. I'd love to see Eli do something else, and I would love to I'd love to partake in his food. And also, I just would love to see what kind of stuff he's doing. You know, this is 11, 12 years ago. He's this young chef. He's aspirational. Like, I mean, a chef's game 12 years down the road, a young chef particularly, has got to be a completely different set of skills.
Yeah, he's the GM of Wood Smoke Provisions. So that is a more recent thing. In the past year, he started doing that. But The Luminary looked like it had great reviews. From the article I saw on Eater, it just was got to be too expensive. Chef Eli, great run by the way, on Top
rents,
Chef.
I will say this, rents in Krog Street are outrageous, and I've heard other vendors talk about that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it was a hot spot. Kevin Rathburn has, I think, or is he in Pont City? One of those two. Both of those complexes have just prohibitive rents.
Well, hats off to Eli. Really enjoyed his run on Top Chef this season. And I also got to say, Kevin, we got to go to a Bocuse d'Or. That sounds like a lot of fun. Maybe they can kind of put like a Summer Olympics or Winter Olympics along with a Bocuse d'Or, and we can just kind of hit two birds with one stone.
I mean, could we like call in some favors? I mean, what do you have to do? I'm looking at the it's all in French here. Do they rotate it's always in Lyon. Oh, that's nice. That could be really nice, Tom. You know,
we got to do it. It sounds so much fun.
When we're like old, late middle age people, it's such a late middle age thing to do, isn't it? We should go to Lyon for that. That would be fun. That would be really fun. Closing thoughts, Tom.
Can't wait for the finale. We got Bangs, Padma. It's been a long time between the finale and this most recent episode with Thomas Keller, because Kevin Gillespie's got long hair, Jen Carroll's got really curly hair, and Padma has bangs. And of course, the Voltaggio brothers look exactly
they
the
look
same.
Like exactly they do exactly the same.
I'm looking forward to the finale, Kevin.
This will be fun. Well, we got one more, and then the finale.
Well, they're leaving Vegas.
Oh, you mean like the final four go up to Napa, the whole deal. All right.
Yeah. So I'm excited for the final four, so to speak.
For Tom Haberstroh, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives. Oh.